Good evening. Good evening. Wow. Technology is always fun. We had a moment's panic here that the microphone stopped working, but we are back online. Welcome, I'm Beth Hessel, the Executive Director of the Athenaeum of Philadelphia. Someone asked me a few minutes ago how long I've been here, and I have to say today marks 6 months, and it has been such a... Thank you, I hope you're still clapping in another 6 months. It's such a joy to be here and be a part of this community. I want to offer a welcome to members, to newcomers, to friends, to sojourners and life dwellers in this amazing city. I want to offer a welcome to the readers and the thinkers, the creators and innovators, the appreciators and preservers and cheerleaders who are here tonight. I want to welcome all of you to the Athenaeum of Philadelphia, which is a historic and lively home for each and every one of us. As I recently heard someone say, the Athenaeum is Philadelphia's cure for ennui. So welcome to each of you. If you are a friend or a visitor, I welcome you and invite you to think about membership in this community. As you can see, it is a good bunch here, and I hope you all had a chance to enjoy our first members' reception prior to the lecture tonight to engage in conversation. I hope that you'll find that after this lecture tonight, you'll want to find opportunities to talk more with one another, whether it be at the next program or meeting over coffee in the library or finding time to invite one another to lunch. And with that reminder, please check your phones and make sure they are turned off. I want to welcome you. I hope you all will make sure, if you have not received our brochure for winter spring programs, that you will pick one up on your way out. After this program, there will be book signing by our speaker, Alexander Garvin, downstairs, and I hope you will take the time to buy a book and get it signed by him. Tonight, we are initiating our winter spring 2020 evening programs with an exciting and renowned speaker. When we think about what a downtown is, or where it is, how we define it, and how we create a vibrant downtown in an ever-changing city, an ever-changing context, Alexander Garvin is a person to engage in this conversation. Tonight, he seeks to shed light on those and other questions. Alexander Garvin is a distinguished urban planner and real estate specialist, with a 46-plus year career in teaching, architecture, and public service. He is currently president and CEO of AGA Public Realm Strategists Incorporated, a planning and design firm in New York City. He has been engaged in as managing director for planning at New York City 2012, which was responsible to bring the Summer Olympics to New York in 2012. Hence New York City 2012. And he was also responsible for planning the rebuilding of the World Trade Center for the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation after 9/11. And as you can see, if you have been there recently, it is a vibrant place to be, and Alexander Garvin has a lot to say about how that happened. He's also held prominent positions in 5 New York City administrations, including Deputy Commissioner of Housing and City Planning Commissioner. Among his other skills and talents, I learned tonight that except for this front cover of his book, Alex took every single picture in the book, so he's a talented photographer at capturing the life of a city. I invite you all to join me in welcoming Alexander Garvin tonight to our podium.
Today I am going to talk about the heart of the city, not the city. I usually talk about American cities, but the heart of the city is what makes the city possible. Take a look at Philadelphia. 6% of the territory of Philadelphia is downtown, but 44% of its jobs and 32% of its taxes. Without the heart of the city, Philadelphia would not exist. And what has been happening in America now for about 30 years is that downtown America has been changing in front of our eyes. You think of downtown as a single place, it's not. That's a photograph of Atlanta. It has 3 downtowns. New York City has more than half a dozen of them. And when you think of downtowns, there are different trajectories of these downtowns. Trajectory number one, and this is true of a number of cities, not just Detroit, the downtown isn't doing well. It's still declining. Take a look at the number of people living in Detroit over that period of time. The second trajectory, is a trajectory of continuing growth. When you think of Houston, Texas, for example, I can't see the screen very well, but I can see on the computer, and I can I prefer to put on my glasses under those circumstances. That is a photograph taken before the highway system was introduced to Houston, when it was being built. And that is the uptown section of Houston. Uptown Houston was basically farmland, then suburban area, and it is now the 17th largest downtown in the United States. It has never been in decline. That's photographs that I took of Post Oak Boulevard in Houston, in the uptown, and you can see how it's been growing steadily for more than half a century. And in fact, those are pictures. The one on the extreme right is a picture I took on Thanksgiving Day. That's not a downtown that's in trouble. And then there's a more common trajectory, and the reason that I wrote my book, The Heart of Downtown, and that is downtowns that are in the process of resurging. Take the photograph there of Lower Manhattan, and then look at the various photographs. The black and white photographs are not mine. The color photographs are. And think of what F. Scott Fitzgerald said when he tried to convey the essence of downtown America, explaining that Lower Manhattan, which in 1929 had experienced the worst Wall Street disaster in history, had all the iridescence of the beginning of the world, confessing that he had erroneously thought that there were no second acts in American lives. Well, Lower Manhattan came back. And in fact, if you look at the next set of photographs, you will see that it's been coming back at regular intervals. Those are all photographs of Lower Manhattan. It is thriving in a period, and we ought to ask the question, why are these downtowns thriving or not thriving? And what is the essence of what has changed? And it seems to me that there are four different explanations of how and why downtown America is changing. The first is changes in technology, and I think the single most important. I can date specifically to 1990, when the revival of American downtowns began. It's the date the internet began, 1990. We also, and think about it this way. In 1970, the average worker occupied 500 square feet. Today, the average worker occupies 150. We don't need filing cabinets. We don't need filing clerks. This technology has changed the way we use the downtown. Similarly, we used to ship in crates. Now we ship in containers. And that has changed the downtown waterfront. The second set of changes have to do with transportation. Since we are now shipping by truck, there's a shift of manufacturing out of the city because trucks don't travel easily in city traffic, but they do on highways. And so you have the shift of manufacturing to the suburbs. Rail yards are no longer necessary because you're shipping by truck. So rail yards can be reused. And then we have been investing in many cities in a transit system. The more we invest in the transit system, the more it changes the downtown, as I will show you in a few minutes. The third reason for these changes are changes in the population. Households don't operate in 2020 the way they did in 1950. Think of your own. Not only that, after the changes in the immigration laws in the mid-60s, we have an enormous immigrant population that didn't exist. There are more than 200 nationalities that live in Houston or New York City. And then there are cities that are very much shaped by those immigrants, Miami and the Cuban immigration, for example. The third population change is the growth of higher education, medical centers, cultural facilities, and all sorts of institutions that locate downtown. You aren't going to find them in the suburbs. And finally, we have had, in the last 30 years, decreasing downtown criminal activity. The amount of crime has gone down. I know people don't like to admit this, but that's what's happened. And finally, we have changes in lifestyle. We have a great increase in tourism, in part because of relatively cheap air flight. That means that people come to hotels in downtown. Similarly, we have changes in the recreation facilities. And let me show you a little bit of what I'm talking about. This is the impact of the internet. Now, I know WeWork is about to go bankrupt, but the way we use our offices has changed as a result. And in fact, my example on the right is in Phoenix, and it's not WeWork. It's a different building. But it's shared facilities. And there you see the square footage. Then what happens is that if you need less square footage, the leftover buildings become vacant. So Class B office space in many American cities was being vacated. If you go to downtown Los Angeles, you will see it, but in lower Manhattan, it's very evident. If you look at the map, you will see what the real estate industry has done. The developers buy these empty Class B buildings, and they turn them into housing and hotels. And so suddenly, you have the downtown population in lower Manhattan, which was around 800 residents in 1970, 3 years ago was 61,000. We now have a mixed-use, high-density downtown with downtown residents. Now, there are cities that had downtowns that always had a residential population. Philadelphia, New York, and Boston would be my examples. But you didn't have that in downtown Los Angeles or in downtown Houston. That's changed. The investment in transportation has had huge impact. It's not just building new mass transit systems that open the airports, but also the changes in shipping of crates and produce and manufactured goods. And if you look at what the downtown port of Boston or Newark is like, you will see it's not near the downtown. You've got acres and acres of backup land where they store containers that come in on boats. You can't do that in an expensive waterfront. Just imagine Philadelphia, Market Street, and the Delaware River. You wouldn't dare to do anything like that with it. It's too expensive. And you can see the change. This is Baltimore Harbor in the 1950s. You can see the shipping all going on there. It moved 2 miles out into Chesapeake Bay. Once the shipping moved out, the buildings that were occupied by manufacturing plants and warehouses suddenly become available for redevelopment. And so look at how downtown Baltimore has changed over that 50-year period. All those buildings in black are new private investment that wasn't there before. So this becomes very important. And as I said before, you don't ship by rail. You can reuse the rail yards. In Chicago, you have Central Station and Dearborn Station, which went out of use, and they were covered over, and they are now residential areas. And in fact, if you look at the map, Central Station is here. And Dearborn Station, that's Dearborn Station itself. Look at all the new housing development there. It's not just on the tracks, it's also in the area all around it. And downtown Chicago, in that section, is a very different place today from what it was when I was a boy. Interstate highways. They are everywhere. But they also allow the downtown to change because you can get out of town very easily, not just get into town. And the result is that you have warehouses and factories in the suburbs, not downtown. And when the lofts and the warehouses and the manufacturing moves out, somebody reuses it. We had this very early on in New York. In Soho, we had these abandoned lofts. The artists moved in illegally. They converted them to apartments. Then the City Planning Commission caught on to that. It was designated historic district, and it was rezoned, and we passed tax laws which encouraged the conversion. And today, this is one of the most fashionable retail and residential areas in the city. And it's not just in New York that this happens. We have an increase in tourism. This is Denver. And if you look at tourism in the United States, it's huge. And aside from Orlando and Las Vegas and Anaheim, most of these others, the hotels are all downtown. And that's where the tourists go, because that's where the institutions are. And they spend their money downtown. And that makes for a real change. And the style of life has changed. We didn't have rental bicycles when I was growing up. In fact, there wasn't as much bicycle riding as there is today. Or jogging. That's also changing how the downtown is configured and what goes on there. When you look at a downtown, everybody says downtown is changing. Well, that's fine. Downtown is an inanimate object. It doesn't change itself. Somebody has to make the changes. So you have to ask the question, who are the people that are changing the downtown and why? And the change is dramatic. That's the same shot 50 years later. And it's not just the people who live and work and play downtown, it's other people that have to decide. It's public agencies, it's private organizations, it's real estate developers, it's artists in the case of Soho. Let me explain what I'm talking about. I can identify five sets of people that are responsible for the changes that we're seeing downtown. Preservationists. Now, that will not be a surprise to a few of you in the audience, I gather. But for others, it will be a surprise, and I'll talk about how they do it. Real estate developers is not a surprise, but also it's important to know how they do it. And we have businesses, artists and architects, and immigrants. Those are the people that are changing these downtowns. Let me explain how. So let's start with preservation. Dana Crawford was a student at Harvard, Radcliffe rather, when she graduated, she moved from the Middle West to Denver. And she fell in love with an area of the city, which is today called Lodo. And if you look at the photograph about the time she moved, there it is, 1963. She bought that block. She invested in renovating the buildings. She purchased the building in 1965. She started renovating it. She persuaded the city of Denver to rezone the area so that it was no longer a manufacturing area, but rather a residential area. And then she made enough money in rent from the block that she sold it at a profit. And today, the main new hotel right near the railroad station is called the Crawford Hotel in her honor. She's just one of these people. There are preservationists in every city that go to work to try to change the downtown. And you can see from the illustrations I have up there the change in 2011 and then 2017 from what she bought. That's a big difference. The second group are real estate developers. In this case, I've picked a place in New York City in Brooklyn called Lodo. And there were, David Willentis was an investor, and he had done the renovation of a loft in Soho and saw this area of abandoned warehouses and factories just across the Brooklyn and Manhattan bridges from Lower Manhattan and thought this was a great place to develop. He started buying there, he started getting people to invest with him there, and renovating the buildings. If you go to Lodo today, it looks like that. It's a thriving new downtown. And you can see Lower Manhattan in the distance, one of the other downtowns. Many of the buildings in Lodo were purchased by the Willentis family and fixed up. And there are now thousands of people there who were not there in 1970. And the average income of the people who live there is some $200,000. This is an extremely popular area. Third group are business owners. This is a business owner, Dan Gilbert, who was born in Detroit, founded Quicken Loans, moved Quicken Loans to downtown Detroit, and has vainly been trying to save downtown Detroit ever since. He owns more than 90 buildings in downtown. But if you look at what's happened to downtown Detroit, it's gone from being the fifth largest downtown in America to being the 27th. To give you an idea, it's not doing as well as Buckhead, one of the three downtowns of Atlanta. well known as a suburban area. Buckhead, by the way, has 10 department stores down in Buckhead. There are no department stores in downtown Denver, which once had Hudson's, the second largest department store in the world. That's a big change. And if you look, the number of downtown jobs, while it is substantial, isn't enough to support the downtown. Look at all the vacant buildings there. It's not doing well. But if it wasn't for Dan Gilbert, it would be in very much worse condition. The fourth group I want to talk about are the artists. They are the people who changed Soho. They also changed the Dearborn Park section of Chicago, the warehouse section of St. Louis, Cleveland, Ohio, lots of places. They moved into the abandoned lofts and warehouses, and they fix them up, and then they sell when the prices go up high enough, and these become boutiques on the ground floor for fancy stores and very expensive apartments upstairs. They have been changing downtown. And finally, you have also architects. This is Printer's Row in Chicago. Harry Weese's daughter had moved to New York in the early 60s, and he went to visit her and saw Soho and decided that that should happen in Chicago. And he persuaded a competing architect, Larry Booth, to buy a historic building on Dearborn Street and fix it up. They had to get the city to change its laws. They had to be able to rent the apartments. And eventually, the whole section became a popular area in the city of Chicago. So architects can play a role as well. And then there are organizations, not just people. They're specially formed organizations that do this. We have 1,400 business improvement districts in the United States. The most successful one is right here in Philadelphia. It is an amazing operation. And from the time it started in 1990, Paul Levy has changed downtown Philadelphia. We have BIDs everywhere now. We have economic development agencies that do this. We have conservancies that do it. We have existing institutions. University of Pennsylvania changed West Philadelphia. Yale changed New Haven. And then we have government. And I want to illustrate examples of each of these. This is the Philadelphia BID. It is a big change. It provides clean sidewalks, wayfinding signs, picks up the garbage, adds police protection. If you didn't have the Philadelphia Center City bid, Philadelphia would not have an alive downtown. It would be much like Detroit, but Detroit has a BID. It's doing all the right things. It's marvelous, but doesn't do enough. They don't have enough people. The specially formed organizations are, for example, the Cultural Trust of Pittsburgh, or, and I'm going to talk about Atlanta Beltline a little later, and conservancies like the Central Park Conservancy. All of these organizations make a difference. We talked about the business improvement districts. It's important to understand that they didn't just happen. Downtowns in 1980 were deteriorating. They had lost their population, they had lost their customers, and they had lost their customers to these places. People didn't go downtown shopping anymore because they went to the suburban mall near where they lived. It wasn't safe to go downtown. That changed with the BIDs. It wasn't clean. This is spick and span. They have people who specially pick up the trash and make sure that it's safe, clean, and attractive. That's what the BID does in Philadelphia. It's what the BIDs do in New York, where we have more than 60 of them. The BID was invented in Toronto. They had this problem in Toronto. They created this institution, and we all copied it. And they saved this particular section. It's not in the downtown itself. It's a little bit out. But It was the first VID, and I thought important you understand. We didn't invent it in America. It came from Canada. And these BIDs do all sorts of things. This is the BID of Stamford, Connecticut. It's called the Downtown Special Services District. It does everything that we've been talking about. But one very important thing, it programs the downtown as well. They have Jazz Up July. They have concerts. People come to from the suburbs to downtown Stamford to attend these events. You have similar sorts of things in downtown Los Angeles. Yes, safe, clean, and attractive. And in fact, you can see Philadelphia on the lower left-hand corner and the upper left-hand. The others are BIDs in New York. And when I say that it has made a difference, take a look at the statistics for 2012 and what happened to crimes between 1993 and 2011. That's a dramatic drop. And you look at what you have, it's astonishing. And here, in dollars and cents, you can see how it happened and what the money was spent for. What happens with the BID is that the city, in this case Philadelphia, does a tax surcharge that has been agreed to by all the property owners in the BID, or enough of them, and then collects that surcharge and transfers it directly to this new organization called the Business Improvement District that have employees and a board of directors. The board of directors is made up partially of government officials and largely of property owners and business owners in the BID. And they work with the leadership of BID to figure out how to spend the money and what do they need to do. What had happened was, after the Second World War, every city claimed that they didn't have the money to provide these services. And if you know how city councils work, the council members like to provide services for their voters. So the money was spent in each of the neighborhoods outside downtown. There weren't any voters of serious numbers in the downtown. The services were withdrawn in city after city after city. That's why the BIDs were invented, and they spend the money themselves. This shows you just some of the BIDs in New York City. We have, as I said, more than one, and that's an old map. You're looking at 2012 when we had 67. There are more now, and 1,400 in the country. Conservancies do this as well. I was hired by the Trust for Public Land in 2004 to figure out how to increase parkland in the city of Philadelphia, in the city of Atlanta. I went up in a helicopter. I had heard about something called the Beltline. And if you look at the drawing, I think I can point to it, there is a freight line that runs through here. In fact, that freight line encircled the entire city about a mile and a half from the main street, Peachtree Street. It was in three different owners. It was discontinuous. Parts of it, the rail line was owned in three pieces by three different owners, and then the discontinuous pieces were owned by other people. And when I went up in the helicopter, I thought, gee, maybe we could create a whole park system out of this. At that point in time, Atlanta had a really insignificant amount of its territory devoted to parkland. So I proposed a plan, tie it all together. You can see this was not parkland. This was available to be developed. We produced the plan literally in 4 months, and the plan thought of the Beltline as a way of connecting existing parks and acquiring new property that could be added to the park system. So you can see the existing parks on the left, the proposed park system in the middle, and the plan that I made in 2004. In 2005, the City Council approved it. The City of Atlanta is now building it among the new parks is a former quarry. It's about, the Beltline is now more than half built. It's being financed by something called a tax increment district, a TIF, tax increment financing. It says that the city collects taxes from the area that will be affected by the investment, in this case, a new park system. It could be a transit system as well. For the first 25 years in the state of Georgia, it continues to collect the same amount of taxes. But as people invest because of the major investment in the infrastructure and public facilities and public realm, the increase in value of real estate produces an increase in taxes. And that triangle that you see there is then used to pay the debt service on the bonds that were issued in order to pay for the park system. At the end of 25 years, the tax increment district expires, but by then, the Beltline doesn't need to buy anything. It's already in existence, and they're able to get other sources of revenue in order to pay for maintenance. This is some of what happened along the Beltline. You can see the new construction. That's 10 years after I made the plan. And this is a new park that's on the Beltline. It's called the Historic Fourth Ward Park. That's 1.5 million square foot former warehouse, which is now a condominium office and residence with stores on the ground floor. It's all been converted. That's a map which can show you where the new investment went and how it's being used. Atlanta was known as a city of major traffic jams. Atlanta is now known as the city of the Beltline because that's where people want to live. And then there are institutions that change cities. This one you're very familiar with. Both Yale and the University of Pennsylvania faced the problem of getting people to come because of crime in the city. And the president of Penn decided that it had gone too far. There had been 30 armed robberies in 1996, and a stabbed biochemist. And so Judith Rodin, the president, decided to do something about it. And they started working with the institutions and the businesses around Penn and with Drexel as well. They wanted to improve safety, improve services, the same things that the BIDs did. They wanted to have better housing choices, revive commercial activity, and so on. And they succeeded. As you know, that's what the university looks like now. Without Judith Rodin, this never would have happened. Same sort of thing happened at Yale. But look at the new shopping facilities around Penn. This is New Haven's version. Yale bought up all those stores on Broadway and fixed them up. They also invested in a home buyer program. They provide a subsidy to first-time home buyers of up to $30,000. They get $5,000 the first year and annual grants of $2,500 a year for 10 years if they agree to live downtown instead of the suburbs. Yale also started fixing up its own buildings, which meant that there were jobs for people who worked in downtown New Haven. So there are many ways that institutions can do this. And governments can change downtown. Downtown Denver is the result of many activities, not just Dana Crawford and the preservation community. The city of Denver invested in a civic center, which it's also the state capital in addition to being City Hall, but they built several stadiums, a convention center, a performing arts center, and they created a light rail system for people to come from the suburbs downtown and from the airport. When you get downtown, there's a free bus that runs up and down 16th Street, which is a pedestrianized downtown. There is bus traffic. That's the free bus you're looking at. But the center of 16th Street is a pedestrian-free area. It's a part of the park system. So when you come downtown, you park your car somewhere in the downtown. You get on the free bus. You go to work. At lunchtime, you get back down on 16th Street. You get on the free bus, and you go to the restaurant. And happy hour, you do the same thing. And then you get back in your car. They created an amazing light rail system that they superimposed on it. Denver's system was voted on by all the suburban counties. They increased the taxes by 0.4%. And that increase went to fund debt service on the bonds, which paid for this new light rail system. So you can take mass transit and go downtown to 16th Street and get anywhere you want. You don't have to go by car anymore. And it's changed. Take a look at how downtown Denver has changed. This is the result of government investment. They do have a BID. They have a university. They have all of these things. And these are some of the ways that these downtowns have been changing. Now, there are five strategies that I found in looking at the changing downtowns that I think we can use to improve our downtowns. The first is reusing obsolete buildings, and I'll talk about Los Angeles. The second is removing barriers, and I'll talk about Dallas. The third is empowering public development. I'm going to talk about Cincinnati. The fourth is providing mass transit access, and finally, putting all the pieces together into a mixed program. Let's start first with enabling mixed use and reuse of existing buildings. Los Angeles had all the downtown office buildings that were not being used anymore, some lofts, some manufacturing plants, and in 1999, they passed an adaptive reuse ordinance, which said, you didn't have to get a zoning change to reuse a commercial building for residential purposes. You didn't have to add the parking required for a residential area. All of a sudden, all of these buildings could be transformed at a reasonable cost. Would have been impossible otherwise, and you didn't need an environmental impact statement to get a zoning change either. Those are all very expensive things to do. The result is look at the change in the number of apartments and the population in the city from 1999 to the present. This is a lively area. As soon as the people moved in, you also got public markets. These are remarkable buildings that were no longer in use as movie theaters, but they could become public retail establishments. And then on weekends, because you now have a residential population, you have outdoor markets. This is the second thing you can do, is remove barriers. That is the Woodnall Rogers Freeway in Dallas. It separates what was to become the cultural district of the city from a developing suburban area in walking distance of the downtown. And some enterprising people in Dallas decided that cut was a barrier. Why not connect the downtown with what seemed to be a developing popular residential neighborhood? So they proposed covering it over with a park. And that is how the Clyde Warren Park happened. You can see the park there on top of the freeway. They spent more than $50 million putting in all kinds of things. This isn't just open space. Parks are for people and recreation. Look at all the different things that can happen there. When I went to see it, it was because one of my students had told me about it, and this was 4 years ago, and on Thanksgiving Day, I flew to Dallas. I went downtown, and this is what I saw. I'd never seen anything that had that big an impact on real estate values nearby. It had everybody there. So I decided to go to Neiman Marcus and see what was going on in downtown Neiman Marcus. There were no people there, but there were here at the park. And in terms of development around the park, it's awesome what's going on. Those are aerial photographs I took at different points in Dallas, and you can see how substantial the change is. Then you can create a development corporation and empower an entity to change the downtown. I had grown up knowing about Cincinnati being a problem, and there were a terrible slum called Over the Rhine. It was right next to the downtown office district, and the population had been declining and declining, and there were murders. Everything you know about downtowns was happening, and it was a very poor area, largely African American, and they had a race riot, one of the worst race riots, probably the worst one in the 21st century. I didn't believe it could come back. The mayor persuaded corporate leaders, including Procter & Gamble, to put up the money to create a development corporation, which would be chartered as part of the city effort, and entitle it to proceed to fix up the area. That's what it looks like now. That's a new public school, that's government, that's a new market, that is in fact the development corporation, that the two parks that you're seeing there were partially a government property, but partially also invested in by the development corporation. The development corporation started by buying up the buildings, which were deteriorated and abandoned. And they did something extremely clever. They bought those buildings that had a retail establishment on the ground floor. Well, most of Over the Rhine had that on the main street. But they bought only those that had a particular kind of retail, bars and liquor stores. They got rid of the bars and the liquor store, and all of a sudden the vagrants were gone. And they started fixing up the buildings. You can see how much they've done on the map there, and there you can see the change in Vine Street from what it was at the turn of the 21st century and what it is like today. So you can create institutions that do this. It doesn't have to be the University of Pennsylvania or a business improvement district, but you have to actually aggressively do things. The fourth is to invest in transportation. I talked a while ago about rail yards being not needed any longer. Well, this rail yard actually is needed. This is the two rail yards behind Pennsylvania Station in Manhattan, as it appeared in the end of the 20th century. They store railroad cars there. That's the Long Island Railroad stores their cars there. So does Jersey Transit, Amtrak. So it's needed. People had been dreaming of developing this property. It's right next to the railroad station. You know about this. You have the same thing here near 30th Street Station. But you dealt with it. We dreamed about it. These are some of the different plans for developing the Hudson Yards, starting in the 1920s. That's the Regional Plan Association of New York. Some of them are more fanciful, some of them are more traditional. None of them happened. And these are just some among 20 or 30 different plans to build on top of the rail yards. In 1995, I was hired by Dan Doktoroff to do a plan to bring the Olympics to New York. And the plan involved trying to move athletes and coaches through the city of New York without putting them in New York City traffic. So we invented what we called the Olympic X. The east-west arm of the X is the railroad. That's the Long Island Railroad and the Pennsylvania Railroad. The north-south axis was a ferry system, and right at the intersection of the two, we were going to put the Olympic Village. And we located all of the sites for the Olympics, some three dozen, accessible by foot from a subway station. And one day I walked into Dan's office and I said, the plan doesn't work. He said, what do you mean it doesn't work? I said, I can't get anybody to the convention center or the stadium we want to build on the west side. Well, what do we do about it? We have to extend the number 7 subway. Nobody had thought of that when they were thinking of building on top of the Hudson Yards. He said, well, how do I pay for it? I said, I'll tell you next week. And I came back next week. This was our plan. You can see there the new office building, which was going to be for broadcasts, a new Madison Square Garden, a new convention center, a new parkland, and you can see how the Hudson Yards were going to be rebuilt. But we couldn't get anywhere there or to the convention center, which was there, that's the convention center. And we had 8 mat sports there. That's the extension of the number 7. How to pay for it? The next week I brought these 3 images to show Dan. That's 1902, the old Grand Central Terminal and its rail yards. The second one is 10 years later. Both of these are taken from roughly 46th Street looking south, but you can see the platforms. And the drawing there is everything built on the rail yards before 1930, starting with St. Bartholomew's Church and going all the way to 42nd Street. Dan instantly understood real estate taxes. He became the deputy mayor and persuaded Michael Bloomberg to pay for all of this by issuing bonds. And the bonds were going to pay for the MTA extension. About $2 billion of bonds. We are now planning to get roughly $20 billion of revenue in new taxes. This is the plan for the Hudson Yards as it existed in 2018 without the vessel. The vessel is now where there was a public square. I'm not saying this is the best design. I think it was much better when it was a public square. The buildings don't relate very well to anything around them, but they have, the investment has changed everything. That's the part that's built. The Western Yards has yet to be covered, but it will be, and the impact is amazing. Look at just what happened in terms of new construction in the neighborhood. We're talking about 17,000 new apartments. This is not on the Hudson Yards. We're talking about 18 million square feet of new office space, not on the Hudson Yards. 5,900 new hotel rooms, not on the Hudson Yards. And that doesn't count what's happening on the yards itself. That's what an investment in transit can mean. So what happens when we try to put all of this together? A new transportation line in Boston, the line that goes from the Boston airport through the Boston seaport. The second thing is an investment company that comes in to develop, and they created one to develop the convention center. You have to have property reuse. They had empty lofts and warehouses. They changed the law to make it easy to convert them. We were beginning to see all the different things that we were talking about all came to Boston to, came together in Boston to change the seaport. And this gives you some idea of all of the things, also investment in the public realm. There is a public park all along the shoreline, which has created an attractive place. This is where the Museum of Contemporary Art is. You have new hotels. You have the convention center. This area is changing as we speak. And all of the different devices that we have been seeing are all here. So what do you think we ought to be doing? I think we ought to be doing exactly what Boston is doing, reusing our territory and becoming high-density, mixed-use downtowns. How do we do it in New York? We had a problem, too, Times Square. Some of you are old enough to know that it was a problem. It isn't anymore. We did a whole set of things there, too. We have a theater development program. You can get tickets at a discount. You had a special theater district. You had investment. You had redevelopment of 42nd Street. You required to have illuminated signage and TKTS and a pedestrianized Broadway, which we didn't need for automobiles. Every city has downtowns that are in resurgence where they have been doing these things. And I am arguing that we need to do exactly that. And if we do, we may be able to save Bridgeport and St. Louis and Detroit. And we had better be doing it. You're doing it here, so I'm not worried about Philadelphia. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I would suggest that one thing we could do is to have bids everywhere. Pass legislation which creates uniform programs for bids in every state and every city. To manage the district public services, to create public development corporations like in Cincinnati, to finance through a tax increment district, the way the Hudson Yards was financed in the Atlanta Beltline, and put in programming as well, as in Clyde Warren Park. And I think we can do a great deal more to make our downtowns better. I will be happy to answer some questions. I will also sign copies of the book downstairs, is that right? After the talk. So let's put on the lights. So let's try somebody. Yes, sir.
What should Philadelphia do next?
I can't hear you.
What should Philadelphia do next?
I wouldn't dare answer that question in this room. All of you know much more about Philadelphia than I do. But I'll tell you who probably could answer it very intelligently. Go ask Paul Levy. The question is, what is the consequence of the inequality that comes along? I think you will find it very interesting. The downtowns began without a residential population, or very little residents. So the gentrification that happens in neighborhoods is not what's happening. The people moving in may be wealthy. That is true. But they're not shoving people out the way the gentrification problem occurs in other parts of the city. The way that you can deal with this, it's simple, but you have to put up the money. And that is for either the city, the state, or the federal government to put up subsidy money to subsidize some of the apartments. It's the only way you're going to deal with a largely wealthy downtown. Yes, sir.
I have a Paul Levy story that would be worth recounting. We lived in Philadelphia in the 70s, and he was, I knew him, worked with him, and he's brilliant. Then I took a 23-year leave of absence to own a business in Cape May. Returned to Philadelphia and immediately had lunch with Paul. I said, Paul, why don't you become mayor of Philadelphia? And he said,
wonderful story. Apparently, they were trying to convince Paul Levy to become, to run for mayor, and he said he gets much more done by not being the mayor. Yes, sir. Can you speak a little louder?
Yes. You made a very good point about the downtowns improving and have a good future. What happens, though, to the areas outside of the downtowns? What can they do to replicate what the downtowns are doing?
They can't. They are, by very nature, not high-density, mixed-use downtowns. They're residential neighborhoods, either urban or semi-urban or suburban. And what you do with the rest of the city is a different book. This book that I wrote is only about downtown. I have written another book called The American City, What Works, What Doesn't. And it is a compendium of the things we have done over the last 150 years to fix cities. It has a long and panegyric section on Ed Bacon and Philadelphia, several sections. But it covers the whole country and not just the downtowns. And I would say that if you look at Society Hill, you have a perfect model of what you can do. That's a different subject. And yes, sir. Yes.
So it's valuable or not. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the mechanism for encouraging development.
We're asking about tax incentives, largely real estate tax incentives we were talking about. There are two forms. There is the assessment, and then there is the actual payment. And you have to deal with both. I managed a program in New York City called J51. And I got it changed in the mid-1970s. It provided an exemption from any increase in the assessment for 12 years when you made improvements to your property. In other words, you didn't punish people for fixing property that was run down. And the second thing they did was to subsidize the fixing it up. And it provided an abatement of taxes equal to 90% of the cost of the renovation, taken at about 8 1/3% a year for up to 20 years, so that you could pay off the investment by not paying the taxes. We salvaged New York City's slum districts with this program. I think that the key is to understand that you don't want to punish people for doing what you want them to do in the city, which is take care of the property. And some places, and we had rent regulations in New York, which you don't have here, so you couldn't increase the rents to pay for the improvements. Therefore, the tax deduction was something that could cover the cost of paying for it. I think you have to look at the situation in every city differently. The assessments and the assessment process is different in different places. The taxes are usually not very fair, by the way. I think we probably need to come to last question. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. The lady is saying one of the things that helped that was the covering of the Big Dig, which is... Yes, but it's not in the Seaport District, which is important to understand.
But,
well, it is only part of the story. The city of Boston has been methodically investing in its downtown. The government center, the Back Bay, the Seaport is only the last example of it. And what you have is a very activist government that cares very much about public improvements in the city, and that doesn't exist everywhere. But it's not just covering the Big Dig. Yes. I showed Clyde Warren Park as an example of exactly what you're saying. But it's not just that. You have to do all these other things as well. And I'm going to go sign books, anybody who would like to buy one. And I think you're going to say that.
Yes. I want to ask that you give Alexander Garvin a head start downstairs so he'll be there when you buy your books and ask him to sign them, and hope you will all show up next week on January 14th. Eric Foner, who is one of the premier historians of Reconstruction in America, will be talking about his new book, The Second Founding, about how Reconstruction changed our Constitution and our understanding of our freedoms. So I invite you to come back again, and thank you for being here tonight.